This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
We can easily remove the alcohol or drugs from the equation and to look at it as just 12 steps of perhaps becoming a more embodied, in-tuned, skillful human being with oneself, which then you're able to walk out into the world and offer to another. Everyone, this is Chris Grasso with the Indie Spiritualist Podcast, and my guest today is Keegan Massara. Keegan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's a great honor.
And
thank you.
The honor is mine. We are going to be talking about, I'm going to call it a book, but it's more, at least for me, an experience. It's called The 12 Steps, Symbols, Myths, and Archetypes of Recovery. And for those of you that are watching this on the Be Here Now YouTube page, I will throughout the conversation show a little bit of the book because it is, like I said, it's more than a book, at least in my experience. It really is. It's just, it's a treasure trove of a lot of wonderful things that I think can help us navigate this human experience with perhaps more skillfulness and ease. So that said, I'm going to read Keegan's bio, and then we are going to dive into what I'm sure will be a very engaging and insightful conversation. So, Keegan Massara is a psychotherapist, author, and creative, a passionate researcher of consciousness studies, meditation, and emotional health. She has long used visual arts, symbols, and myths in her practice to facilitate access to the empowering resources of the inner world. I love that. Pretty much sums up what I've been getting to know about you over the last couple of weeks since we've been emailing and had a really nice phone conversation yesterday. So I thought, Keegan, where we could start with this is the book itself. So much to dive into there. 12 steps. Formed, you know, by Bill W. and Dr. Bob in, the late 50s in Akron, Ohio, is changed many, many lives. Lots of stigmas attached to as well. We can unpack all of that. But what I love about this book is the accessibility to certain people that may otherwise have kind of not really felt a resonance with AA or 12 steps or any other 12-step program per se. My mom, early on in my recovery journey, actually read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's not an alcoholic, nor is my father. But you know, she read it and she said, "Chris, wow, everyone could benefit from reading this book." I said, "Right? Like the 12 steps, while yes, in that book directly are related to alcoholism, it's a blueprint just to live a pretty accountable life filled with integrity." And what your book does for me and a lot of people I've spoken to who have read it is, again, just make it more accessible. And for me, it's a, I don't know, a big heart experience. It's my teacher, Ram Dass, always talks about loving awareness and love and heart. And that's what I felt and feel while reading your book. So, all of that said, why don't we start with the journey that you were, you know, that you went through writing this book? Like, What inspired it? What did you learn about yourself? I mean, so much to uncover. Where do you want to start with this in that area?
Well, thank you for what you're saying about the book. You know, I got as far as delivering it, and then that was sort of my only vision, to complete it and to get it to the printers. And so I haven't really had a vision for what's coming after that, you know, how it would reach its readers, so to speak. So, but there's been some really major discoveries in the course of it. So the actual inspiration of this book came when I was visiting. I live in France now, but I was visiting my dear friend Sandra in London, and we share love of art, of books, of consciousness studies, of meditation. But both of us have also spent time in Japan, and when you stay with her, you sleep with a row of books behind you, a lot of art books. So I was looking at some of her Japanese books on art and ended up with one on rock gardens. You know those stepping stones that are so typical in rock gardens in Japan?
Yeah.
Well, they are there, you know, in calm water, but they can also be there in moving water. And anyway, I was looking at these images and just loving them. And in the morning, I woke up, and it was one of those distinct moments, you know, that you always remember. Like, this little kind of sentence popped into my mind, and it just went, what a pity the 12 steps haven't been illustrated yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was literally like that. And I did not particularly think that this was an idea for a book. But what happened from that point onwards was that images kept on finding me, you know, and they would speak of these remarkable steps in one way or another. And eventually I started to collect them. I was really steeped in another project altogether, which had to do with emotional skills, and did not want to distract from that. But eventually, you know, I had a collection of images, and I decided to do a proposal and literally went to New York, to one of my favorite places in this world, which is the Archives for Research of Archetypal Symbolism at the Jung Institute in New York, where there is another dear friend of mine called Ami Rönnberg, who then was the curator of this place, and they have something like 20,000 archetypal images. And so I sat in this library writing the proposal and going through the different drawers, finding images and stuff. Then went back to Europe. Now, I should say another thing as well, and that is that this archive, with Ami as editor-in-chief, they created a book for the same publisher as this book, Passion. It was called The Book of Symbols, which has been a very much loved book. So back in Europe, I at one point had a conversation with Ami and said, and she asked me what I'd done with the proposal, and I said, nothing. And I said, do you think that Passion could be interested? And we both basically went, recovery from addiction, don't think it's up their stream.
Right.
But she said, why don't I send it to the editor we worked with, which she did. Which then led to a journey, you know, where I got a contract, and then came the very inspiring, fun, and messy, chaotic journey of creating it with lots of insights, lots of learning, till I reached last November when it was delivered to the printers. And at that point, I realized that I was going to have to talk about what I'd written.
Mm-hmm.
And that threw me. And so, you know, with these questions of how am I going to do that, these kind of uncomfortable questions that we end up living with, the tension of that. So I was living with that for a few days. And then came a memory. And I allowed myself to basically... Just, I allowed myself to go down the path of storytelling that this image had. And it was literally an image of being in the north of Sweden where I grew up, very, very snowy winter, and of going to see somebody who'd come to live with friends of my parents. And it was a young Indian boy who, I was told that I had to be nice to and I had to play with. And what happened was that I discovered that all his toys were Indian gods and goddesses. And all he played were the myths of these gods and goddesses. I was absolutely fascinated, kind of blown away. I was probably 6 or 7. And my father told me at some point why he was there, this boy. And he said that a man called Mahatma Gandhi had overthrown the British Empire by nonviolent way or approaches to change. And then he showed me a photograph of this Gandhi who was standing there, you know, this spindly little legs, you know, loincloth. And there's just no way this guy could have overthrown the empire. And then I looked at his eyes and his smile, and it, something just awakened me or reminded me. And I just knew that his strength was inside. It was his inner life that mattered. And it awakened me hugely. And he had kind of figured out the secrets of life. And I wanted that. I wanted to figure out the secrets of life, which I subsequently realized were sort of guides for living and guidelines for living principles, universal principles, perennial wisdom and all of that. So what followed in my life, and I can see that now, is that I went down many paths of healing and transformation in quest of these principles, or trying to figure out, you know, how to get inner peace and how to just find these guidelines for living, because I was not prepared for life. Now, the 12 steps are absolutely masterful at helping people align with some spiritual principles, universal principles in everyday life. They have proven again and again and again for millions of people that they can be liberated from addictive processes. They've guided people across rough terrains that have brought them home to their authentic self and to thrive hugely in their lives. Yes. And this is something that many, 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 many people are looking for today. Because whether you're an addict or not, you know, just being human can be extremely tricky to navigate. We're both spiritual and human.
Yeah.
It's a messy journey. And what is so astonishing with the 12 steps is that the process of the 12 steps can actually be applied to many different, whether it's substances or compulsive behaviors or other issues. They are based on universal principles, spiritual principles. And I feel that they help reconcile, they help human beings reconcile being spiritual and human at once.
That's making me think of something. I was very honored to interview, over 10 years ago now, the late Father Thomas Keating, a Trappist monk. Yeah, love Thomas Keating. I found out through his work, through one of my other teachers, Ken Wilber. And yeah. I love Thomas Keating's work. And when I was speaking with him, I said, I mentioned that I was a person in recovery. And I've told this story on the podcast before. So for those of you who've heard it maybe 100 times now, I apologize. Here's 101. He said to me, I'm in recovery too. And I remember thinking, I didn't know Father Keating used to get down like that. But he went on to say, I'm in recovery from the human condition and the varying degrees to which we all suffer. And it was a light bulb moment for me because, to be honest, up to that point, I really did have a very basic view of recovery as strictly just drugs and alcohol, which you know, there is importance in that because I understand that that is a specific thing, you know, within our the neurochemistry of our bodies and our minds that needs to be addressed. But when he said that, it was a pretty profound moment for me. Yeah. And I feel like I had some blinders on that immediately just. And you know, my teacher Ram Dass said, suffering is the sandpaper of our incarnation. It does its job of shaping us. So I think that all lends itself to what you're doing in this book and what you were just saying and what my mom said after reading the big book, how this stuff, we can easily remove the alcohol or drugs from the equation and to look at it as just 12 steps of perhaps becoming a more embodied, in-tuned, skillful human being with oneself, which then you're able to walk out into the world and offer to another. And wow, if I'm not even gonna say if we all did that, but even if just some more of us started doing that, maybe they inspire some more people to do that. Like the ripple effects, one never knows. I talk about that a lot. You know, like you throw that little pebble in the lake and the ripples go out. Random acts of kindness, you know, like simply paying for someone's coffee or whatever, holding a door open, just smiling at someone. Who knows? Maybe they then in turn will be inspired to go do that as well.
Yeah.
So let me rein that back in though, because yeah, there's a lot of different directions we can go with that.
But you know, what I also feel is that it's so, they are so timely in our chaotic era because we're living in this arms race of human attention, as it's been called.
Yeah.
And this is not top-down hierarchical structures, you know, the 12 steps. They are very grassroots. The ethos is very grassroots. It's local. It's cheap. It's mutual help. It is... I mean, it makes sense that people come together to have a common problem and help each other recover. Right. You know, there is something extremely, I would even say, sort of democratic about it. You know, I think it's very, very timely for our era, where because we live in sort of a civilization that is in a sort of a system collapse. We live in the chaotic transition of the old to new paradigms. And we live under the influences of a lot of addictive. I mean, you could even say it's sort of addictive pressures, really, to become addictive, you know, to this and that and the other. And so there's something about remembering that there are simple solutions. And I think that the process of the 12 step is incredibly effective. And anyway, as you can hear, I'm an enthusiast.
Well, as am I, hence our conversation. So while we're talking about these steps, maybe we can explore some of them. You know, you go through in your book and you what I really appreciate and adore about your approach is that you completely honor the steps as they were written, but you put a bit of the word accessible just keeps coming up to me with your book for humanity, a bit of an accessible approach. And so you know, I don't have it bookmarked, so bear with me as I'm pulling it up right now. But, you know, and we don't have to go through every step, but, you know, for example.
You know what?
Yes.
You know
please.
If you think about that, the book, if you want, is an honoring of the 12 steps.
Right.
I mean, it's called the 12 steps. But these 12 steps, they're placed in this field of overlapping influences that speak of these principles, these universal principles. And
right.
these, and so in a way, it is to kind of, my idea was to try to kind of elicit a sort of a sense of what could this be. So we could even say that with a kind of, if you take a sort of guiding principle for living, you could take honesty, for example, you could say that It is a very universal suggestion in religions, in esoteric schools of thought, etc., etc. It shows up a lot, the idea of living along aligned with honesty. And in the 12 steps, you have, it's represented all over the place, self-honesty in step one, and more self-honesty in step four, honesty with somebody else in step five.
Yeah.
And then in step seven, you have honesty with something that is greater than yourself, whatever you understand that to be. And in step 10, it is suggested that you're honest in everyday life, that you're mindful of it.
Yeah.
And that is what I love. I think that the you can find these universal principles sort of show up in most of the steps, actually, in one way or another. And when I have mine as well.
Yay.
Yeah. And so when I was, you know how it begins? It has the 12 steps, right?
Yes.
And then it has an opening page, right?
Right, absolutely.
Here, I've sort of basically turned the spirit of the step into a verb.
Yes.
Admit powerlessness.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And how... I mean, who hasn't experienced, talking about just as the human experience, who hasn't felt powerless over something in their lives? Who hasn't been in despair over something they couldn't change? Who hasn't felt like an utter failure when they couldn't change something by willpower alone? We're not talking about helplessness here, which is so often learned in childhood. We're talking about just the limits of being human, you know? And that is what I just find it so moving that a group of white waspy men, you know, mostly Christian in the 1930s, could come up with these principles. Anyway, you know what I feel like just sharing, by the way, is because what is a bit unique about this book is that it uses symbols and myths and artwork, right?
Yes.
To try to communicate these things, so that it's not just text. And this image, you know, it's not obvious, but this image of this man, it's a painter called Safet Sek. It describes the journey of finding images and artwork for the book.
Yeah.
Because to look for it is really not easy, you know. How the hell do you do that?
Yeah.
So in my case, I kind of have to either stimulate, I'm in these states anyway, or being image receptive, but I sometimes just stimulate myself to get into that. So I'll go for a walk. You know, I live in Paris and plenty of galleries and plenty of beauty, you know, that you can clue in. And I always turn right when I normally turn left. And I do these kind of things where I kind of get out of what I can be in my head. And this image came when turning right onto a street I'd never been. And on a lamppost was this, it was just chock-a-block with little notices and, you know, et cetera. And was this tiny little poster of this particular painting. And I went, step one, you're step one. And then followed a 3-year journey to track down the artist who had moved to another country altogether. And then let alone to get the rights to use it, let alone getting a high resolution of it. But, you know, for me, this to be able to bring imagery to the 12 steps is like such a... It truly is an honor, because it's not that they necessarily always speak about them, but just that journey has been particularly powerful for me.
I love that. So what I'll do really quick, and again, we don't need to go through each one, but just for listeners that aren't familiar, because I kind of had this idea, and it's just becoming more clear to me as we're having this conversation that while this podcast episode is absolutely for those who struggle with any semblance of drug and alcohol addiction issues, substance abuse. It is just as applicable, or I want to invite, you know, anyone that is a human being into this conversation. So what I want to do just quickly is read, as you've kind of reinterpreted them, if that's correct phrasing, the 12 steps. And perhaps if there are a couple, I know you talked about the honesty, which yes, that is so huge, underlies almost all of them, if not all of them. But there's a couple that jump out that you want to speak to after I go through them. And if not, we can leave alone. And because again, there's so much to talk about. But let me at least do this for any readers that aren't familiar or listeners, and also those who are familiar with the 12 steps, but have not had a chance to check out your book. So we have step one is admit powerlessness. Step two is open to help. Step three, make a decision. Step four, take an inventory. Step five, be truthful. Step six, let go. Step seven, humbly ask for help. Step eight, list harms done. Step nine, make amends. Step 10, be mindful. Step 11, pray and meditate. And step 12, help others. Mm-hmm. Which, how beautiful, beautiful. I have a reverence and a respect, as many listeners know, for Alcoholics Anonymous and for other 12-step fellowships. I don't advocate one over another. If it helps you save your life, become a better human being, blessings. You know, whatever works for you. This book certainly works for me. I love this book. So there was a bunch there. Do you want to, are there any that popped out to you that you wanted to dive into for this conversation, or do you want to move on to something else?
Well, I mean, first of all, as you read it, I realized that for anybody who doesn't know anything about the 12-step recovery or the process, or for somebody who might notice that they have an issue with something or seeing it in somebody else that they care for or is concerned about the sort of mass addiction going on in our society, that it might seem like a mighty task, all of those steps, but actually, it is something that is never done alone. It is done with others. And if you can, I mean, I think that it's very helpful to see it as that what 12-step recovery addresses in a way is the brokenness of connection, you know, that is so typical in our society. You know, the brokenness in the connection with ourselves, with others. We isolate, we're separate individuals who manage this, should be managing everything alone. And often also there is a disconnect with the spiritual dimension of our being. And so a lot of us live in a disconnection, in a disconnected state, so to speak, from the multidimensional possibilities that there are. And with these steps form a process that heal connections to the self, to others, to the spiritual dimension of one's being. And it is done with others who have a similar problem. So it is not, even though, you know, I suppose that I'm just pointing out that it might up front look like a lot, but actually it's something that takes place within the loving care of a community of people who are helping each other do this. And sometimes people do this very quickly. Sometimes they take years at it.
Sure.
It's very, very individual. And what stands out to me is probably what is the most controversial element of the 12 steps, which is that it, you know, that creates a lot of barriers for people to use them. And that is what is called barriers of entry, I think. And that is, for example, steps two and three. which were immediately upon admitting powerlessness over something, you know, I can't stop this, I cannot do anything about this, we go on to something where it's suggested that we turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. And I mean, it, you know, somebody who's just been, I mean, this could be really, really tough, but yes, it is, if you look at it symbolically, it's really a suggestion that you admit that you haven't been able to do it alone.
Yeah.
And that, you know, learning to ask for help is terribly difficult. It's even harder to learn to receive help. But actually, it is something that we kind of need to do formally in order to commit to the journey of recovery. So I feel that steps 2 and 3 are very easily misunderstood because of the archaic language they have. You know, the classic AA literature uses the word God hundreds of times in many of the steps. And even though, you know, many people call something greater than themselves God, or there are many, many ways of naming that which is greater.
Right.
But it is a mystery what it is, and people are going to kind of have all kinds of names for it. So steps 2 and 3, I feel, could appear forbidding, but the living reality of it is that you do not have to have faith in God to do them, and you do not have to be religious to do them, and you do not have to convert in any way. And all of this is done completely on your own terms. And I think somebody like Thomas Keating was very good. You know, he wrote a book about...
I found out after the fact. I didn't know it at the time. Yeah,
it's a very moving book.
The 12 Steps in Centering Prayer, something
exactly
of that nature.
I think that was the title.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that stands out to me as something that can be just seen as, you know, too much ask.
Yeah. And if I can just contribute something to what you were just saying, because having worked in the field off and on for years myself, a blessing in a way, my parents believe in God per se, you know, something greater than themselves. I was never really forced to go to church, something I would run into countless times, whether it was teenagers I worked with or adults, didn't matter. They had a real disdain towards AA as a religious. And it's like, they say they're not religious, but these, like you said, the word God hundreds of times. Mm. You know, what I appreciate about Bill W., though, I know towards the end of his life, he did kind of reconcile with the church and become much more of a religious person. And that's his right. Wonderful. Good for you. He did say early on in the big book, and this is paraphrasing, not verbatim, but, you know, to Christ I concede a great man, but thereafter religion and I part ways. And he talks about, I believe, like a universal consciousness or a spirit, you know, something that is greater than ourselves. And I often try to refer people that are a bit hesitant about the religious thing to that. Or I will also remind them, kind of piggybacking on the points you were just making, that if you walk into a room of 12 steps, whatever the fellowship may be, or even the Buddhist approaches, there's some wonderful Buddhist approaches to recovery, that in and of itself is a power greater than you, because you are no longer alone. You now have a community of people that understand what you have gone through or are going through. That's good orderly direction, God. That is a power. It doesn't have to be a religious guy in the sky with the beard keep smiting you with a tally board, you know. But I understand where they're coming from. It's difficult. So I just wanted to add that little bit, because that is more than anything else, I would say, that is the biggest deterrent to people towards embarking into a program like AA or NA or whomever else.
And which is a pity, because look at the alternatives. The alternatives can be costly.
Yeah.
The alternatives can be not always great. They can help you become abstinent if it is a substance. But, you know, the aftercare is not necessarily available. et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And also it is what we contribute to a group, right, that matters. It's not just what a group gives. And Carl Jung had a very interesting idea around the God problem. And that is that, you know, he uses archetypes that are symbols of sort of the collective human experience. You know, you have a mother archetype, you know, everyone has that's so associated with different qualities like unconditional love. And then you have the personal mother who's not, wasn't necessarily unconditional in her love. And so he says that because the archetypes represent the collective human experience, if you want, and it exists in the collective unconscious. And so therefore, because humanity has so long been related to their gods and their the greater forces of the universe, he says that in the collective unconscious, it exists this God image, and he calls it an image of God. And in the way that it shows up personally will be experiential, and it will be highly individual. So it exists already, an image of the transpersonal, but you can relate to it in any way that you do. Mm. And I think that's helpful because it just speaks of a kind of, it speaks of the openness, actually, of the openness of
the vastness, the spaciousness. Yeah. I know, I feel what you're saying.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It to me, what you just described was almost a really lovely description of spirituality, you know, versus religion per se, a very personal, direct experience. Mm-hmm. Andrew Harvey, another mystic,
talks
quite a bit about the value and importance of direct experience. But he's also very clear, and I appreciate this about him, that can also be tricky, you know, because we have our egos, and the ego loves to always find its way in, whether it's creeping in the back door or whatever. You know, and even we might have these profound direct experiences of this, you know, divinity. And, but then, you know, we come out of that experience and the ego creeps back in and wants to tell us all about it and tell us what it thinks it is. So the direct experience is, that's kind of more the path I think I've been on my whole life. I don't necessarily call myself anything. I have a deep reverence for the great wisdom traditions, particularly the mystic tenets of them. There's so much. Those to me are the blueprints for living a good human life. And I fail miserably at it every day, but I try. I try, you know. But yeah, it's there. So I thank you for so eloquently conveying Jung's wisdom teachings. I lived in LA before I came down here in a happy accident. I was skateboarding one day and it was two blocks away. There's a Carl Jung Institute, small library. And I paid my $25 yearly membership, even though I was only there for about 3 months, but that became like a second home to me. You know, I would skateboard over there and they had a nice little patio. I'd bring maybe a snack or buy a snack there. And they had a couple of copies of the Red Book, the actual Red Book. Oh. And when I was married, I was living in Ottawa, really wonderful human being. I gifted her for a short time and it might be back out, but we're going back 5 years or more now. But they'd repressed it again. And so I scooped one up, I don't know, $300-$400. But because my ex-wife was huge, just like me, huge Jung fan. And we got divorced and it was very amicable. But part of me, I remember looking at that book as I was packing things up, like, oh, I'm glad it's in good hands and I'm glad she has it, you know. But one day I hope to own that book. What a masterpiece that is.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So you were, I don't know, we were at what, steps 3 and 4 or 2 and 3. Did you want to keep going through those? We have about like, say, I don't know, 20 to 25, 30 minutes left. Again, I told you yesterday, I had a feeling and it's becoming abundantly clear to me that this is a conversation where we will have to reconnect again, perhaps later on in this year. You know, maybe explore more of this and what are else. I'm a big fan now of yours, and I am excited to continue watching what you are going to gift this world with. So that said, in the spirit of time awareness,
yes.
Where do you feel like going from there? Do you want to finish those or you want to go somewhere else?
You know what I would love is to talk a little bit about symbolic perception.
I would love that too.
Yeah, because, you know, I feel that we are at such a critical state.
We are.
And you know, one of my passionate kind of hopes is that, you know, is to communicate, I suppose, that there are solutions and that the 12 steps are actually very timely.
Mm.
The idea of aligning oneself with universal principles and all of that, you know, it brings up a lot of different things. One is, what is the obstacles to do that? And so many of us are traumatized, especially if we're addicts in one way or another, if we are caught up in addictive processes. And I mean, the more that the human history is being rewritten today, the more we know that we are a traumatized species, period. And therefore, you know, it's difficult to align with these principles if our somatically, our bodies, we have traumatic responses to, for example, trusting or putting our faith in something. And I strongly believe that there are fantastic ways of being liberated from our trauma now. And I mean, I'm a great fan of tapping, for example, EFT, which I think, again, is a great, I've worked a lot for about 20 years with that and helped a lot of people with just being relieved of their traumatic content, so to speak. But it's also something you can learn to do yourself and stuff and do in groups, right? But beyond that, if you're thinking about how do we align with this, you know, what are the principles that we would like to live aligned with? Well, I feel that the part of the paradigm shift is that we're going from an idealization of what the mind can do to maybe experiencing more of the different faculties we have. And one of the most amazing faculties we have is symbolic perception. And that sounds maybe, what the hell is that? But it is, you know, it is a way of getting a bird's eye view on subjects, including something like addiction. It gets very, we take things personally, we're sensitive human beings. And it's not easy to kind of get an overview, you know, and to find our way always. And what symbolic perception does is that it creates space in order to see a problem kind of maybe from a, you know, with more space around it. So if you take, for example, a difficult relationship you're in, and you're always trying to make the other person change and you're trying to do your own changes, what have you. With symbolic perception, you can just go, okay, if this was a play or if it was a series I've been watching or a da-di-da, you know, what does it resemble? And what do these characters, what are they trying to get? What are the bottom lines here? And what would the audience want my character to do? For this to have a happy ending for everybody involved. And so you can endlessly kind of create ways of knowing if you want, additional ways of knowing if you work with symbols and if you work with myths, because they also speak about the human dilemmas and the human conditions, and they always offer solutions. And if you work with art, we know today, you know, that, well, it's estimated that the brain processes images 60,000 times faster than it does with words.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, you know, we are becoming image dominated as a culture, right? So we can actually trust a lot of the knowing that comes from these additional faculties of ours, you know, the intuitive one. What does our gut tell us? You know, can we trust our instincts, or maybe not our instincts as much as our intuition? You know, what does our heart tell us? How do we feel when we are in our hearts? And so I feel that that is something, in a way, that is maybe my personal interest and why it led to bringing in myths and symbols in this book, because I feel that it connects us with greater resources.
Mm.
And we can get answers, you know, yeah. In many different ways to our problems, and we can, but we must ask.
Always.
Yeah, that inconvenient thing of asking, you know, for help.
That's why, again, coming back to this book, I love it so much, is for me personally, and most people that are, I guess, have found their way into my circle, is very aesthetic, you know, very visual. I love the arts. I love sounds, music, auditory. And I love reading too. I love books. You know, I got the word bookworm tattooed across my knuckles.
Oh,
I do. I used to hate reading. And then I was in college and my professor, who turned me onto the entire spiritual path, gave me a book to read, and I fell in love with reading. And it's typically more nonfiction, but I've more recently, the last few years, gotten back into some fiction stuff because there's, for me, a place for that too. But at the end of the day, yes, as far as like absorbing and retaining information, I think we were talking about yesterday, I love YouTube. I don't have much time to watch movies or TV shows these days, but YouTube's great because you can find 5, 10, 15, 20 minute, very informative pieces of information and engaging in the way that it's conveyed, whether it's someone talking to you or the little charts or the animations. That's so wonderful. You know, I wish I knew how to do that. I would love to do that. But yeah, back to your book. That's why I'm loving it. And that's why, at full transparency, I did tell Keekan yesterday that I'm about halfway through. Thumbed through the whole thing, but I'm taking my time with this book because, like I said in the beginning, it's an experience, and that's what I love about it. My first book, Indie Spiritualist, I was really excited because it came out, I think next month or in April, it'll be 10 years. It came out 10 years ago. And Atria with Simon & Schuster, who put it out, wanted to make it as multimedia as possible. So they were doing QR codes. So it wasn't the same as yours, with the graphic aesthetic. They did use some different fonts, and the cover even was a grit material that we agreed on. And the cover itself, we went through a few different variations. And then I recorded an album of music of my own songs to accompany certain chapters that people could, if they wanted to, listen while they read. And so, yeah, I love, like, so again, that's just why I was super attracted to your book. Aside from it speaking just to my heart and much of my own life experience. But again, yes, the fact that I remember when I was looking at the pictures on Amazon, I think one of them it said like human consciousness. And that's, those are like, yay, that lights me up hearing those words. And in relation to recovery, okay, I'm listening. Yeah, take my money, you know, but I'm so glad that, you know, that, again, only being about halfway through this book is already, shifted my perspective of my own journey and path. And I'm sure by the time I'm done, it will. And this is a book I know I will return to many times over for the rest of my life. So yeah, sorry to kind of steal the platform for a moment, but credit where it's due always.
Well, you know, may I then say that, thank you. I certainly hope it will serve. And, you know, when I first held it in my hand, having worked on the computer, I was really, it was like a completely new experience. And the person who did the designs for the designer of the book is very interested in sacred geometry and such. Mm. And there is, I feel that what he's done is that he's brought serenity to the pages. I'm really moved by what he's done. And it can be all kinds of challenging subjects, or certainly addiction can be a challenging subject. I'm super moved by what he did, his contributions there. So
yeah,
I'm really grateful for that.
As am I. It's, yeah. I can't wait to hear feedback from anybody that listens to this podcast or checks it out on the Be Here Now's YouTube page. Because, yeah, and again, while we're just mentioning it, I will take a moment just for anybody that is watching, not to give anything away, but you know, Mark, you can just see, you know, some of the really beautiful pages.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah. Anyways, there's a lot more of that, but I, yeah. Anyways, so yeah, we've still got, you know, maybe 10, 15 minutes. You know, I jotted some notes down while we were talking about, you know, things that were coming up for you, both in the process of writing this and as well as, you know, the after, you know, now you're talking about it. I think we've touched on most of them, but one thing, we've probably talked a little bit about this, but I did note yesterday the importance you were talking about our emotions or the lack of emotional skills, you know, that we as humans are given in life. I'd be remiss if we didn't at least touch on that even briefly before. So please.
Yes. Well, thank you. I mean, it happens to be a real passion of mine. And, you know, I came across this only the other day when I knew that you and I were meeting. So I'm going to read it to you. I've got it right here on my computer. Great. And it is from Ram Dass. And he says, I was trying to leap into cosmic love without dealing with emotionality, because emotionality was a little too human for me. Mm-hmm. I love that. And so I feel that so many of our challenges have to do with being a traumatized species and being traumatized in our individual lives so often, much like Gabor Mate's works and others. And in that, it is as if we're frozen at trauma points, an awful lot of us. And so it's very difficult to relate to the emotional system, so to speak, in a constructive way. We haven't been taught how to do it in school. We haven't, very few of us have learned it growing up. I mean, most of us, or anyway, I was raised by very well-meaning, kind parents who thought that they were preparing me for life. Well, that wasn't the case. And I certainly didn't learn anything about how to deal with my emotions. I saw my mother's family blow up a lot, and my father trying to kind of be a peacemaker. And I saw all kinds of dysfunction that I learned in terms of how to relate to emotions. But emotions are actually part of our other faculties that are there to guide us. You know, they're like sight and hearing and all our senses. It's, they are amazing. They communicate with us, but we are so cluttered by our emotional, the fear of the sensations of emotions. You know, we're so afraid of feeling that sting of hurt or the kind of the sensations of sadness, or we can't bear the after effect of anger, or we haven't learned how. And it's very understandable that we're afraid of them, because emotions trumps logic every time. You know, if we look back on our lives, we can see, you know, what made a lot of our decisions were our emotions. And so I feel that it relates very much to why people end up in addictive processes, as a way of numbing, as a way of escaping, as a way of repressing, as a way of just anything else but the emotional reaction or feelings or experience. And so the what Ram Dass eventually had to do was that he had to deal with his emotionality. Mm. And it's not that difficult, you know. You have skills for that are about everyday life emotions. And when emotions are, I mean, and that would include getting used to feeling the sensations of something and even listening out for the message that an emotion will have. If anger comes, we can be pretty sure that boundary has been broken somehow, or something needs to be put right. But if we carry emotional baggage in our system, then that gives fuel to our everyday emotions. So they become strong. And it's understandable that we fear them. So learning a few simple emotional skills is huge. And that also holds for people in recovery, because so often relapses happen over emotions.
I know about that. Yep.
And therefore, you know, learning to getting used to allowing emotions to sort of just speak their sensations and possibly also communicate their messages. Is it to slow down? Is it to, you know, what is it? What is this emotion trying to say? And there's fantastic literature on that. And the other thing is, I mean, that will turn the emotional guidance system it allows it to do its job. If we have a few of these skills under our belt. And the other one is, I really, really feel that emotional baggage in our system is just really, we can so easily release it now and in safe ways. And, you know, I'm a proponent of tapping, as I said. Yeah. There are many different systems that are very, very good, very safe. And to release the emotional charge of our memories, of our difficulties, even our traumas, then we don't have to carry it anymore. And then it doesn't have to influence us and lead to illness and what have you, as we also know it does. So no matter what, I think that we're called collectively as a species to evolve emotionally and to allow emotions to do their job, and instead of just reacting and becoming self-destructive.
I want to honor that, you know, as with most things in life, of course, easier said than done, nevertheless doable.
Yes,
with today patience, it is.
Today it is. Today the resources are hugely available.
Yeah.
And they're safe and they're fantastic, effective, all of it. I mean, we have all the resources today.
We do. And you know, I want to invite anybody listening or watching this conversation to please... And this is easier said than done too, but it's been something I've been very cognizant of and really trying to apply with myself over the last year or so, is being more gentle and kind and compassionate with myself in various different ways. You know, I've written about that in my books. You can find out tips and practices on that anywhere, YouTube, Google. They're your friends. You know, they are your friends. But learning to just be gentle or a little bit gentler with ourselves. I remember... I had Miguel Ruiz Jr., Don Miguel's son from the Four Agreements, on the podcast once. And he said something that really hit me hard. And I'm sure he's not the first to say it, but the way he said it, and I've shared it a lot with just friends or coworkers, and I remind myself, is he said, you know, our 100% one day may be way up here, but let's say Monday it's up here, Tuesday it's down here, you know, lower on the pole. Doesn't mean that it's not any less of 100%. No, it's still our 100%. It's just the 100% of what we have to give that day. And just like I was saying earlier with the discernment around direct experience and Andrew Harvey, that I found myself, you know, I can be like, oh, well, I gave 100% yesterday and this is my 100 today. Am I really giving 100? Maybe not. Maybe I'm given 60 and I'm just telling myself. So I have to kind of check myself. Discernment, you know, is important for me in my life. But also, again, gentleness and just giving it your best. And if you make a mistake or you mess up, okay, you're a human being. It's what we do. But we also recover in a myriad of ways. We also inspire other people in our own journeys, whether it is specifically recovering from drugs or alcohol or just recovering from being a human being. You know, like, so thank you for that. And one resource I did want to mention, I'm sure you're familiar with this book too, is Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score, another profoundly beautiful book. It's a long read, but if for those of you that don't like reading, we have audiobooks, you know, and that is one that I have read it, but I've also listened to the audiobook. I highly recommend that book too. And I know the Be Here Now Network puts links to various books usually on their page. So if you're on the Be Here Now Network, scroll down. You will see a link to Keekan's The 12 Steps. Maybe they'll put up Besser Van Der Kolk. And if not, Google it. Find it, you know, your local bookstore or Amazon, if that's easier, whatever your preference is. But there's so many resources out there. Are there any, Keekan, that come to mind for you that you want to share? Or do you think we've covered that end of things?
Well, I mean, I just give you personal experience because I think that, you know, I for example, I put on my website, it's keekanmosara.com. I put a bunch of emotional skills that was meant to be a book one day, but I just felt that they needed to get out there. But you know how I actually came to become more gentle with myself was literally through ritual. I lit for years a candle every morning, and just it was a mantra that just developed, and I just thanked the universe, and I said, thank you for my self-compassions. Thank you for my self-acceptance. Thank you for my self-forgiveness. Thank you for my self-expression. Thank you for my self-care. Thank you for my self-respect and self. Thank you for my self-love. And this little mantra just literally has melted me, you know, my self-critical voice, etc. So I think that we can with ritual, we can with direct bodily somatic methods, do things like what you're talking about. And Gabor Mate also wrote about these, you know, when the body says no, for example. I mean, there are many, many, many resources that I could recommend, but I just feel that we, you know, we have to also go looking a little bit to find them. And I feel that one thing that I would like to add, and that is that you remember that quote of Jung's about all chaos?
Oh, I do. Absolutely. I don't have it memorized, but yeah, it's in all chaos, there is a cosmos, and in all disorder, a secret order.
Mm. That's right. Mm-hmm. Our attention at the moment is a commodity. And for us to remember that, number one, we have to, but it is very wise, no matter what methods and techniques we use for our inner work and our healing and transformations, it's really important to just remember to focus it, you know, to what it is that we want to be inquiring, and rather than seeing it dispersed endlessly and seeing it used for the benefit of other purposes. And so our consciousness is sacred in terms of, from my perspective, you know, sacred. And it is to be cared for. It is to be loved. It is to be appreciated, protected, and directed. And so that is nearly, and especially in terms of all in these chaotic times, we have to hold on to it, you know?
Right.
And there is a secret order, and there are solutions available, and we are not, and like the cover of this book speaks of, we are not alone.
That is correct.
And what if you think we are not alone, and with unified physics now proving the fact that at the heart of matter is unity and connection, we now have scientific evidence, especially since September, with Nassim Haramein's paper, you know, the original mass and the origin of mass and the nature of gravity.
So I was not aware of that. I don't forget, I'm going to put in my phone, but please go on.
Yes. So I've been following his work for about 20 years, and he has actually now got this paper. Basically, is the his research that is offering a unified field theory, and the whole area of physics is called unified physics. But if it is now proven that at the fundamental level of matter, there is unity, not separation. And we live in a world view, you know, where everything is separate and Mm. You have to get to the smallest part and all of that. Imagine how much safer we will feel when we get that we are connected, we're not alone, that the nature of life, all of life is connected. I mean, it is what indigenous cultures have always said, and esoteric societies too. But imagine if spirituality and science comes together like this.
And that's what I love. You know, you're saying, I'm thinking of the teachings of the Gita or the Upanishads and the Vedas and, you know, what the ancient yogis and rishis and sages were saying thousands of years ago. And here we are just catching up with physics, but that's okay. Better late than never. Welcome. We've been waiting. Hey, let's have a conversation. My friend Betsy Chassie did a really important film, which she admits in retrospect, they took some liberties. What the bleep do we know? I think that was an important conversation starter. And it spawned or helped elevate a lot of important voices in that field. You know, Joe Dispenza, I adore his work. You know, I've gotten to speak with him in Phoenix once, and what a brilliant mind, and you know, what a great resource for humanity. Many others, you know, in that film. But yeah, I do appreciate Betsy's kind of said, we might have stretched some things, but you know, at the time we just wanted to get the conversation going. And thank goodness they did. I saw that when I was in college for drug and alcohol counseling. My professor showed us that film, and around the same time she gave me a book to read. So yeah, it is. At least again, direct experience. I've had, you know, the Satori, the emptiness, those beautiful Chris has left the building, nature mysticism. Undeniable. I've talked about my show covering Slayer, one of the most famous heavy metal bands, satanic heavy metal bands. I'm up there in the front with I have a photo pass covering it for a website, and there's flames and upside down crosses and people crowd surfing and moshing. And I'm doing the I am loving awareness mantra that Ram Dass taught. And I'm taking pictures and I do love that music. And I look behind me and it's just, Chris was removed from that experience, and it was just the interconnectivity of life, like lifing itself through everything. And it was a pretty miraculous thing to have at a Slayer concert.
Yes. Well, I mean, it is huge to realize that there is one source, that which is, you know, however it exists itself. And it is a very delightful life to be lived, you know, when we also align consciously with some of these perennial guidelines. And because if we align with them individually, we align for the good of all.
Yes.
If we are interconnected, it means that, you know, we set our intentions, but it will then benefit everybody. And so there is something about being a co-creator in these times of upheaval, in this chaos, that secret order, I think, and that secret or that invisible cosmos has to do with stepping in to just contributing. We are co-creators with our minds and with our intentions and with our emotions. And there is much for us, you know, much personal and collective happiness ahead if we do so consciously. So, yeah.
Wow.
Well, we'll run out of time, maybe.
Yeah. Well, like I said to you yesterday as we were getting off the phone, I'm feeling the same way. I'm feeling lit up. My friend, my friend Matt, his wife Julie said that to me when in conversation. I think that's how she worded it. It lights me up. And talking with you and reading your book absolutely, undeniably lights me up. I'm so grateful that this is in the world. Again, for listeners or people watching this, you can find this book literally anywhere books are sold. If you want to support your local bookstore, I always recommend that. You know, go out and support those stores, have them order if they don't have it. Or if you have Prime and you just want to get it right away, hey, I do that too sometimes. I get it. It's available everywhere books are sold. Your website again, you said, was it Kikan Massara, KIKANMASSARA.com? Is that correct?
Yes.
Great. And if you're on the Be Here Now website page, just scroll down. We'll have that linked. We will have a link to where you can purchase this book. And again, we'll have links to other books and resources. Please visit Kikan's website, and I have not. It's still actually up on my phone. I have a few different pages open, and yours is still. It's been on there since we first connected. I didn't realize you had those resources for emotional skills. So I know what I will be exploring this week. Thank you in advance, and I will send you an email to check in and let you know. But yeah, before we close, that's your address. The books are out there. Anything else you'd like to leave our listeners or viewers with before we say goodbye for now?
Well, just a lot of gratitude, you know, a lot of gratitude. Thank you, Chris.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you for your appreciation of the book. I genuinely hope it will find its people, the people it can serve. Mm. And thank you to everybody who's listening to us as we're talking about these subjects.
Yeah.
And I think the real bottom line is that we do not have to do everything alone.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, we actually never have to anymore.
Yeah. So if you're listening or watching, please, no matter how difficult it might feel in this moment, I want to let you know I've been there. And I felt very unworthy of help. And it's by nothing short of grace, you know, whatever you want to attach to that, feel free. But I will use the word grace of something outside of me. That's the reason I'm still here having this conversation today. And I have learned to reach out for help now. And it still is super uncomfortable. I was just with a friend last night giving me a ride. But I thanked her. I said, thank you for this opportunity for me to allow help. Because I've done this for other people too. I'm sure those of you that are listening or watching have helped others in your own way. So please know that you are just as worthy and deserving as that help is literally anybody else's. So please, no matter how difficult it is, please ask somebody, please reach out for help. I promise you, you're worth it. And the beautiful thing is, if you so choose to after the fact and you're on your healing journey, you can step out and help others, you know? Mm-hmm. That direct experience we've had, unless you've gone through it directly, you know, no one, they can empathize, but they'll never fully comprehend. So, you know, please, you know, get well for you first. And then if you feel moved to, help others that have gone through similar things to you in whatever capacity you choose to, if you feel up to it. And if not, that's okay too, but please take care of yourself. So with that, thank you everyone for taking the time to share in this experience with my dear new friend, Keekan. And, I look forward to having you back on the show again, which will no doubt happen somewhere in the hopefully not too far future.
It's been a delight. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.